This is the third in a series of discussing the history of Ananda as seen and told by the people who lived through it. So, among other things, we're creating an oral history of the founding and expansion of the community. The last two times, one was the first time we talked about Ananda before there were houses. And so that was the first early years of moving to the land. And then last time we talked about Ananda from about 1970 up until the beginnings of this this year's panel, which will start with the fire and move to about 1980. So the fire was in 1976, in June of 1976. Those first years up until the time that we're going to talk about today were largely consumed with several things. We were establishing Ananda really very much from a pioneering energy. Started out, Davy's first home was a tree house. My first home was a tent. Many of us lived in teepees. Gradually we began to build houses, but much, much more importantly, we were establishing Ananda's vibration that was always there with Swami Kriyananda because he was so clear. But having one person who understood what Ananda was about and the attunement with Master's vision for communities is not enough to produce a community. A community is a group of people who commune together, who work together, who communicate with each other, who cooperate with each other. And so in those very early years, that was the primary, one could say, spiritual and social task that we had. Yes, the physical infrastructure, the businesses, all of that was very important because without those, we couldn't have survived on the land. But had we come here as a group of rich kids, able to build anything that we want, we might have been able to survive on the land more easily, but there wouldn't have been a spiritual purpose to it. And so establishing clearly that spiritual purpose, among other things, at risk in the very first years was whether this community was going to be dedicated to Master or not. And that was a very serious battle, one might say, over the first few months, because many people came who were not disciples of Master and who were just trying out the spiritual path. But that became established. So gradually over from 1969, which the reason we have the celebration and the oral history on July 4th is that July 4th, 1969 is when we took possession of the land, not that we're sitting on right now, but where the farm is and Ayodhya and much of the other land. Where we are right now was a piece added a few years later, but that's told in the histories. I would very, very much like to recommend anyone who's interested get these two books by Sadhana Devi. The first is Many Hands Make a Miracle, Ananda through 1968 to 76, and the next one, Expanding the Light, 77 through 90. And that they're in the boutique, and you can get them if you don't have them, and if you don't have them, you should get them. So the time up until 1976 was really spent establishing our presence on the land. And gradually the tasks enabling us to stay here became gradually more complex. It is more difficult to build a good home than to erect a teepee, for instance. It is more difficult to build a home once you have to follow county regulations. And so in 1974, we had a moratorium placed on all future building until we produced a master plan and began following the county building codes. And so we were established, but struggling for our continuance at that time. Another aspect of that time period between 1969 and 1976 is that when you talked about Ananda, you talked about this piece of land, even to the extent that the meditation retreat, to a certain extent, was thought of. There was a little split in our minds. It was the meditation retreat, and this was the farm. But when you talked about Ananda, you talked about those two places and the group of people that lived on it. Now, when you talk about Ananda, it's a movement, and it's a worldwide location everywhere and nowhere. But that concept, that reality, had not taken place yet by 1976. It was going to start to be established during the period that we're going to talk about this morning, and you'll see how that concept, that's very important, the movement from a physical place to a movement and a consciousness, how that expansion happened. Since I was the only one on the panel, I don't think, Pooh, you fought the fire, right?
I was aware.
Yeah, and Ananta, no. The others, Anandi did, Devi did, Sadhana Devi, no, and Durga did. We were all part of that fire, but I guess I was the only one with a back pump and up trying to put out the flames. So I'm going to talk about the fire and how that happened. Most of you are aware of where Oak Tree Road is. That's where Mother Truckers is for you visitors. That's that little store that you pass about a mile and a half down the road, Tyler Road. Up along Oak Tree Road, a little over the hill as you go to North San Juan, a county piece of county equipment, I think it was a road grader or something, didn't have a spark arrestor on it. And it was a dry, you can imagine the weather being much like it is today. It was half a month earlier, but not much more than that. So it was already dry. It was already hot. And that county piece of equipment without the spark arrestor gave off a spark. It went into the grasses and began a grass fire down by Oak Tree Road. Now, in those days, the fire response was nothing like it is now. Today, if that had happened, as it did just 2 days ago, a much bigger fire in a shed near the same location, it was out in probably a half hour or an hour. If the fire response had been like that, that fire would have been out too, but it wasn't. And so the winds were blowing in our direction, and gradually that grass fire began to grow and spread. And it began to come up the hill. If you go up to the metal building, the yellow building, or what we call Sunset Ridge, the flames by about 11 in the morning had begun to come up and were clearly coming up toward Ananda. And so a group of about 15 or 20 of us gathered along that road at the crest of the hill. And our primary firefighting equipment in those days was a backpack that held about 5 gallons of water and had a nozzle on it that you pumped. And it was better than one of these squirt guns. But it was basically a squirt gun on steroids. And it worked very well if you had it in your house and there was a little chimney fire or something like that. You could grab that little device and put that out. But we didn't have anything much more other than hand tools. At any rate, we gathered up on that ridge and we could see that the flames were coming up toward Ananda. At this time, they were still pretty much grass high. You know, the grass had grown up and still a big grass fire. And our thought was that along that road at the crest of the hill, when the fire came up there, it would cease to burn along that natural fire break that we had there. And so I actually ran down the hill very foolishly and with my little pumper, thinking, well, if I can suppress the flames a little as they're coming up the hill, that's going to really help. Well, I saw that was going to be an absolute impossible task. But by that time, running up the hill, I couldn't outrun the flames. And so I was in actually a somewhat perilous position. And I turned around and I ran and I jumped through the flames into the area that it had already burned, and then came up behind it, still attempting to put it out. Well, by the time it reached the ridge there and that road, it was already throwing off a lot of sparks. And so it didn't even really pause at that road. It just sparked on the other side and continued to burn. Also, by the time it came up onto the ridge there, it had begun to spread out laterally. So it went up toward what we now know as the Kushler's place and cluster A at that time. And so it went up, and we had at that time about 22 houses that had been built. But as it began to spread out, it turned from a grass fire and it began to get into the trees and it began to grow in height. So what had been a fire about 3 feet high now became a fire that was 30 feet high. And once it was in the trees, for us, it was absolutely unstoppable. And so those of us who were here fighting the fire at the time were trying to do what we could to save structures by this time. There were also, by now, the county had responded. There were tanker trucks here, and there were airplanes coming, dropping fire suppressant. And so it was really like a war zone. By the time it began to hit the houses, all of the houses, the only way that we could cook were by propane stoves. And so by the time it hit those houses, you could hear these massive explosions going off because those propane tanks were exploding. And Davy and I had a little dome, small one, about where Mary Kretzmann's house is at this time, just a little up the hill from that. And so the flames had, they were 30 or 40 feet high. The terrain was not cleared like it is now. You have to think of terrain as being very brushy. The way as you go over to Ayodhya, you see all the uncleared areas. It was like that all the way through the community. And so those flames now were beginning to come down and threaten the houses because we hadn't expanded very much. Our houses were down closer to the central area. And so those flames were coming down, and I was with a little kind of a tool called a hodad, a hoe on one side, and I was trying to produce a little kind of a path around the dome, hoping that I could stay inside of that and defend that. And smoke was all over. The bombers were going over. It was the propane tanks exploding. And actually, Vidura's son, Dwayne, he was a teenager at the time. He came driving down in a truck, and he said, "You've got to get out of here. You've got to get out of here." And I had been so focused on trying to do this little fire break and save the house that I didn't think anything about looking around. He said, "The flames are huge. You can't stop them." And I looked up, and probably 200 yards away, maybe 100 yards away, I could see, you know, flames through all of the trees. And so we had no time whatsoever. Davy had cleaned our altar, Our baby was 11 days old at the time. And so she had just had the baby. She was going to taking our baby into have its first medical checkup. And because she hadn't had any time to clean the house, before she left, she thought, I want to clean the altar. It's the meditation room. It's getting a little dirty. And she took our sacred objects and put them in a box, expecting to come back and clean the meditation room. So here was this enormous fire coming down the hill. We had only 2 or 3 minutes. And so there wasn't any time to save anything, but I ran into the house and I grabbed that box of sacred objects, and that's what we saved from the fire. Then we came down and we were trying to save what else could be saved. The only real structure, it did not burn down in, because once it gets into grass and begins to come downhill, then it slows way, way down because the heat tends to push things uphill. But there was smoke and flames and noise all around. We did have a crew then that was all around Publications Building, which was the only major building, which is Hansa Temple now. That building, which was the only major one, we had a crew around that, and we were able to save that structure by putting out sparks that came near. But by that time, the fire burned pretty much the entire community in up above that and took out all but one house. The one house they were able to save was really nothing more than a tar paper shack. And because it had been on the north side of the hill, it did not burn down into what's known as Ayodhya now, and those houses were saved. But that enormous, it was really like being in a war zone for about 3 or 4 hours, and a tremendous battle. And at the end of that, there were no more houses at Ananda, and there was just ash. And we began the rebuilding from that time on.
Oh, well, in our case, I'm Sadhana Devi, by the way, if I haven't met you. And in our case, my husband Jaya and I went through 2 fires that year. It was bicentennial year also, and we used to say, well, we have the bicentennial fire. So we had a fire earlier in the year. If you were here last year or if you've known us, we for some time we had a crew of guys who would go and work for the Forest Service for on contracts planting trees to make money. And so that winter, I don't know exactly why, but they chose a contract in Oregon in the winter. And it was a big contract. It was going to go on for some weeks and months, I guess. And so they thought, well, maybe the wives could come too. So we had 4 of us. Four women came along. There were Lakshmi, myself, Kirtani, and Hridaya. And we got to stay in a campground that belonged to, you know, the Forest Service. And we had little travel trailers to stay in. So we did what we could we cooked, of course, and that was obvious, something that needed to be done. And we tried to keep the place, you know, somewhat sattvic, best we could do. So we were there for quite a few weeks in the rain, in the middle of winter in Oregon. And we had a fire. Our little trailer caught on fire. I saw it when I heard my daughter screaming. She was 2 years old at the time. And, of course, I started to... At first, I thought she was Lakshmi's daughter. And I was, you know... Lakshmi will take care of her. And then I saw the smoke coming out the windows. And so I ran, you know, Bigfoot. I ran into the trailer, opened the door. Of course, the minute I opened the door, the flames shot up. And I ran in and grabbed our daughter, ran out. And as we made it out the door, a piece of the trailer fell right behind us. And so after lots of shouting and yelling and so forth, many people came out, of course, and got buckets of water. We were in a campground, remember, which they don't usually have running water. You have a pump. So buckets of water went on the little trailer. Someone had the presence of mind to turn off the propane tank. But anyway, when it was all over, we looked inside the window. There was one of our SRF lessons there, all kind of charred around the edges and kind of black. And someone said, "Well, the words may be immortal, but the paper's not." So that was our first experience. And when we got back, we were here for a few more months, and then we had the next fire. And a Jyotisha, I remember, said to us, "You guys must keep a change of clothes or something in a safe deposit box somewhere in case of this happening." So those were our two fires for the year. Well, I was not fighting the fire. I was at our little house where we lived, and I could see the smoke coming. But it's really hard to gauge where smoke actually is when you're, you know, just out and around. And to me, it looked like it was already where Jyotish and Devi lived, and which is in Ranikhet. And but in fact, it was still on Oak Tree Road at the time. Eventually, someone came to our house and said, "You know, everybody's beginning to feel like this is getting dangerous. It is going to come on our land, and it probably would be a good idea if the women and the children at least were off the property and somewhere safe." So I got in the car with this woman. She had three children, and I had one, and we went off. And by the way, at this time, our same tree planters were off on another tree planting project, so they weren't here to help with the fire. And we went off to a place which is still there. It's called the North Columbia Schoolhouse Cultural Center these days. If you ever go past the turnoff to the meditation retreat on Tyler Foot, keep on going. It's about, I don't know, a quarter of a mile or something. And it's up there. And it was a school, a one-room schoolhouse since the gold rush, I believe. And it was a working school. But of course, it was summer vacation, and so we were allowed by someone let us in and allowed us to stay there and just wait out the fire and see what was going to be left, if anything. So we did so. It was nice. It was, you know, a place to be inside, and there was a playground. It was a school. It had bathrooms. It was an okay place to be for the afternoon. And I remember that late in the afternoon, Devi and Lakshmi came. They had been in town bringing Kalidasa to the doctor, and so they were just returning from there. And so that was their first knowledge of the fire was when they returned from town. And we all waited there until evening, and finally someone came to tell us that it was all gone. There was really nothing left. In actuality, there were three structures left, but they were none of them up in the area where most of the homes had been. And we spent that night at the meditation retreat. Sure was a nice to have that place there, because we were able to go up there and stay, have meals, and, you know, have a halfway, you know, easy way to spend that time. And I remember thinking throughout the night as I was falling asleep, you've probably heard the story that Swami has told sometimes about how he was really exhausted from his work at some point. And he had another big class he had to give that evening, and he just didn't know how he was going to do it. He went in and laid down, but instead of taking a nap, he went over every little project, every little commitment, one at a time, and consciously let go of each one, one at a time. And so I had heard that story, and I realized what I was doing before I didn't realize at first what I was doing until I noticed that I was going over every one of our attachments. Oh, there was our daughter's toys, and then there's the family photo album, and there's the coffee pot, or it gets more and more trivial as it goes by, but each one I would see it in my mind's eye and let go. And by the time I got to, you know, fairly far into all of that, I was falling asleep. And it was a very good way to get through that first part of it, knowing, you know, okay, we enjoyed this. This was nice. Now it's gone. And I remembered that a few days before the fire, I'd been looking at our stuff and thinking, wow, we sure have a lot of stuff. We could use a good fire. Let that be a lesson. Be careful what you think. So the next day, we came back down here to the village, and I was quite surprised. There was no chaos. The place was smoking. It was black. It was smelly. Everyone was in the front yard in front of the market. But there was no chaos. People were discussing what's the best course of action next. Who's going to go off and check, make sure there's no spot fires. Who's going to do this, who that. No chaos. No one was angry. No one was weeping. None of that. Everyone was just, oh, okay, this is our next adventure. What do we do now? And we did this. So we came, and this is what happened. And within, well, the next day, our guys came back from their tree planting expedition. And I'm going to let Puru tell the story of how the forest ranger came and gave him the big news. So they came back the next day. And a housing committee formed real soon. Maybe it was our very first housing committee. I don't know. But housing was passed out in a way that was quite appropriate. You know, the ones that needed a big house got a big house. Smaller ones got smaller houses. And it was appropriate. It worked for really just about everybody because everyone was willing to work together. And so we did that, and we had that. The next day or two, I guess I was in town, and I was quite surprised. I went into the bank to tell them I lost my checkbook and so forth. And I explained, and so they, you know, gave me another checkbook and all of that. And I turned around, and there was a woman behind me, and she said, this is terrible. I'm so sorry for you, and this is just awful, and how can I help you? I've never seen her before. She gave me her phone number, and, you know, said, we had a similar experience over and over again. And I really saw two things that happened as a result of this. I saw, one, what community really can be. I grew up in a small town, 3,000 or 4,000, 5,000 people, something like that. Small high school. We knew everyone. I think I knew the name of everyone in my high school. Well, of course we helped each other out. You know, small town like that, everyone knew each other, and most people were related to each other. So, and so, of course, there was that. But it was nothing like what we had, the kind of community we had. You know, as Swami has said, that most cities begin because of economic possibilities. You know, there's work available, there's farmland, or there's this thing or that thing that makes it possible to have business and to have, you know, have an economic base. But that's not what we're doing. We're not here just to make money. We are here for something higher, something, a spiritual life, and that's the most important thing to us. And I saw that putting the spiritual practices into action were what got us through all of this. As I said, I went into town, and to my surprise, I found many people coming forward to help us. I have to say that until that time, I may be the only one who noticed this, but I didn't notice that we were all that welcome in Nevada County. Nevada County was not the cute little tourist town it is today. It was a place in the economic decline. There were lots of buildings boarded up, and it was not, you know, not a very place that people looked to come to. But we came in, and, well, we all had lots of long hair, and we didn't look like somebody that they knew. And I have to admit that, you know, people like that have been here for generations, and they, you know, they see us, and all they could think was that we were bringing drugs into the county, and they, you know, were not especially that excited to see us. And what was funny was that we were not doing that, but our neighbors were. And so the people who were the local people who've been here for years didn't like us because they thought we did drugs. And our neighbors who did do drugs did not like us because we didn't. So So I guess we weren't really all that popular here for a long time. But we were quite surprised at how many people came forward to help us. I remember someone went out and bought a sleeping bags for every single person. And there were, 30, 40 people went out and bought a sleeping bag for everyone. We had things, we had mountains of clothes that were given to us, donated to us. And somewhere there is a picture of Durga in the middle of the mountains of clothes sorting out. But we can't find the picture. If you ever come across it, let us know. It's very important. We were given money. People sent money. We sent out a letter to spiritual organizations that we knew had done things with. And one was the IYI, Swami Satchidananda, who used to come and visit us from time to time. And I remembered that, you know, we have the number 108. That's part of 108. That's part of our our path. And we got a donation from Swami Satchidananda for 1,008. I thought that was kind of cute. He probably thought 108 was not very much money. So I sent us 1,008. So we had this from everywhere. And we had people who came from those groups also to help us to rebuild and to clean up. And we found that, you know, as it said, when you pursue the highest dharma the best you can, things help. Things come to you. The universe comes to help you. And so this is where we saw it, that this is what was happening. So.
Well, I'm Puru, for those who may not know me. I was one of the group that was gone when the fire struck. Just for the historical record, we were tree thinning, not tree planting. But we were in the back of beyond, somewhere far north of here, and we were staying in a campground. And only the Forest Service knew where we were. So we did, in fact, get a visit from a forest ranger who said, we got a message to give to you guys, you know, some kind of fire, maybe buildings burning. So we dropped tools and climbed in the cars and drove as fast as we could to get back here. And we got here late in the evening, and when we got here, you could just see, you know, clouds of smoke coming up from everywhere. And what I remember perhaps the most in the aftermath was the fact that there was no thought that it was over. There were a few people left. There were some families especially who left. It was just going to take too long for houses to be built. And they were perhaps having a difficult time with being here at Ananda to begin with. And so there was kind of a bit of a exodus, but it was very small. But most everybody, there was just no question. It was more, what are we going to do? Not, should we? There was no soul searching about the need to maybe go somewhere else or start fresh in a new location. Was just, let's do it. And there was a number of wonderful pictures. I remember one in particular taken from the various cleanup days that we had, where we had to clear out all the charred brush. And I still remember one of Asha. She's holding this burnt bush in her hands, and she's got this old soot-smeared striped shirt on. She's just got this radiant smile. And that was really the story. It was not sad. You know, Jyotish hasn't had this quote mentioned yet, but his comment to Devi when he saw her or to others was, well, I guess there's no more problems with those leaks we were having. That there was just this wonderful, let's meet this head on and let's do it with gladness and joy and energy. And that's what happened. Now, the actual work of rebuilding was aided in large measure by the fact that we were able to sell a lot of timber that was dead but not burnt. So a lot of pine trees, when they get in the heat, the sap actually boils. And so it kills the tree, but the tree doesn't necessarily catch fire. So we had all this standing timber, and a enterprising forester came and visited us and said, you know, if you let us at it now, we can get it out of there before the bugs get it. And that was a big nest egg for rebuilding, was selling the timber. We also did a number of fundraisers. I don't know who came up with the idea, but at some point or another, brave souls were driving down Broad Street in Nevada City with speakers broadcasting that we were going to be doing a fundraiser for the Ananda Fire. And as Sadhana Devi said, there was a lot of local positive support for us and a lot of sympathy for our problem. And so we got good turnout. We had a lot of local people help us with the extravaganza we put on. People sang with us and so forth. So it was quite heartwarming to see that kind of support. And as Sadhana Devi also mentioned, we had other spiritual groups come up and help us a little bit further on in the story with the actual building. And there was a group. Does anybody remember where they actually came from, the 3HO people? Was it?
I think Bay Area.
Was Bay Area. So I couldn't remember. I just remember one of them, his name was Guru Tedit Singh. It has stuck with me forever. Their last names they all take are Singh, but he was Guru Tedit Singh. And they were, you know, joyful and positive, and many of them had carpentry skills. So it was a great work day that we had with them. And then some years before the fire, Swami had struck up a friendship with Stephen Gaskin of the farm. And Stephen Gaskin originally met Swami at a conference. I think it was in Canada, but maybe it was just up in the Northwest. And we got to laugh a lot because a quote that Stephen Gaskin, a quotation of something that he said to an interviewer, appeared in a magazine about Swami Kriyananda. And he said, "Swami Kriyananda is the real deal. He's not one of these guys with the two-piece screw-together pool cue. He's a straight guy." So they had bonded. There was a great connection between the two of them. And, he, of course, the character, they couldn't be more unalike, Swami and Stephen Gaskin, but they saw in each other that genuine integrity. But as a result of that, several people came from the farm and actually lived with us for several months, helping us rebuild. So the rebuilding opportunity we had gave us the opportunity to rethink where to place our homes. As Jyotish once remarked, our urban planning process up until that point was really a matter of figuring out how far you could get from anyone else. And that's where you put your house. So they were just spread all over in the kind of forested area up above what is now laughingly called downtown Ananda. And because of that moratorium on building, that particular practice didn't continue. And then everything burned down. So now we had this master plan in which we had said what we wanted to do was cluster housing more and keep big swaths of our property open and greenbelt and just more natural preserves. So we concentrated our building in what we call Raniket now, was known for eons as Cluster A, left over from the purchase of the property, I think. And so we started building homes fairly close together in that concentrated area. And one of the things that was decided was to build a bunch of domes. And as Jyotish mentioned, he had already been living in a small dome. Swami had always been someone who liked the idea of domes. He often extolled their virtue of having the curved roof that he said felt was more naturally conducive to the mind instead of a flat hard roof. So he was a big proponent of it. We had the domes up at the meditation retreat. So the decision was made, let's build a bunch of domes for those who suffered in the fire. And we started off building four domes, one of which was a double dome for a larger family. And we did it systematically. So we were, the big part of the domes are these struts that form the actual lattice of the dome, the geodesic dome. So we made them, mass produced them. You have to cut the ends at the right angle and put these little slots in them and drill them and various things. So we had big piles of these for all the domes that were being built. And meanwhile, we were building the foundations and then the floor. And the floors, because it's hexagon or octagon?
Octagon.
Octagon. Bottom?
Yeah.
Hey. Yeah, so the floors are these octagon shapes.
That's why they leaked.
Yes. So we had all these, like, I kept thinking of them as like the giant thing they put out for the elephant to stand on at the circus, you know. We had all these platforms, and then we started on the struts. And I got involved in this because this was actually my second year at Ananda. I came in 1975, and I got involved because I was asked to be the carpentry leader for what we then called the apprentice program. The apprentice program was how a lot of people would come and stay at Ananda for the first time if they were, you know, serious and wanted to be here for any length of time. And I was kind of scratching my head as I was thinking about this the last few days as to why I was chosen to be the carpentry coordinator, because, and I realized it was because I showed up with a carpentry belt with actual tools in it. And that was pretty much my qualification for leading the crew that was working on these houses. And the people who showed up, as frightening as this may seem, knew less about carpentry than I did. Now, luckily, there were other crews working on other domes, but we were doing what we could. And so I was sort of in the midst of this and watching these structures go up. I remember wishing that we could sort of stop at one point. We had one dome in complete lattice. It was fully formed, but we hadn't put any of the plywood triangles on it that would seal it in. And it was starting to rain. This was well into the winter at this point. And so we put plastic over it to create this kind of workspace. And it was great. I loved it. It was just this, like living in this translucent bubble, you know. But that eventually got closed in. And it was an interesting process to see how, in fact, many hands make a miracle when many of those hands don't know what they're doing. And eventually, I don't know how long it actually took us to complete it. How long before you guys actually got in? I think yours was the first one habitable. Was he?
Yeah, by August.
Yeah, so it's 4 to 6 months, which is, you know, you can't even get a permit now in 4 to 6 months. So it was remarkable that we did it, and the money came in from here, there, and everywhere. And suddenly people were in. Now, the other thing that we were looking at that same time, in addition to the rebuilding process, was reforestation. And we just happened to be trained professional reforesters. We had all the hodads and we had the bags that you put the trees in. So for a couple of weekends in the winter, those of us who knew how to do it would go out, and you kind of get this team going where you all walk in a line. So you stay the same distance apart and you kind of make your way over the hills and down the vales. In unison, planting trees every 10 feet as you go. So we did that throughout the community. Now, the survival rate of small seedlings like that is very low. But many of those trees survived, and there's whole sections of Ananda that, you know, I can remember actually came up because of the planting. So that took a little longer to show, but the, you know, the spirit and the creation of the homes was, to me, a fascinating expression of community spirit and just the willingness to work together and do it.
I had just become a member before the 1976 started, so there was a membership committee. Took about 45 minutes to give you an okay. The extensive vetting that goes on these days was not available, which is why I got to be a member. But a few years earlier, about 1970 or I think it was 70 or 72, Swami Kriyananda asked Honnell Cassidy to come and live here. And Honnell was older. He was in his 70s when he moved here. He was an accomplished man of the world. He had been the head photographer of Condé Nast magazine, House and Garden magazine. He had raised two children in Manhattan as a single parent. He had then traveled to Chile. He had traveled to Southern California, where he was probably at the time, and maybe still, the world's expert in biodynamic farming. And the good thing was, he was a disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda and Akriyabhan. Swami Kriyananda got wind of that. Honnell had lived in Encinitas. He had the key to the little meditation cave in the cliff at Encinitas, where Rajasi and Master used to meditate. And he would work 6 days a week on his farm, his little truck vegetable farm. And on Sunday, he would go meditate all day. So he was living the renunciate life. And then he was asked by a certain organization we won't name to turn in his key and not go there anymore. And it was sort of like, huh, that's odd. Somehow Swami Kriyananda found out about this and invited him to come and join us here with this undertaking of the community. Honnell brought world-class expertise in the field of biodynamics to us. And looking back, I realize, as with all of Swami's ideas, how much foresight and how brilliant his perception was. Because coming out of the 60s, organic gardening was a winner-take-all proposition for everyone. It was just crazy. And Honnell Cassidy brought science and religion together. He was a personal friend of Dr. Aaron Fried Pfeiffer, who is the founder, who no one's ever heard of, but anyway, he was Rudolf Steiner's biochemist. So Honnell came with expertise and dignity and life experience, and I always thought, and it would stand corrected by Joe Chishindavi or anyone else, but I kind of thought of him as Swami's reinforcement in the direction of dignity, refinement, professionalism, and getting this done. And if we were going to succeed, our wonderful enthusiasm for his example was absolutely true. If you had a tool belt, you were an expert carpenter. Others were not as great, you know. But Honnell brought just a standard of excellence to us. Imagine us all at the age of 20, 22 years old. And this is a gentleman who had accomplished it and was a Kriyabhan. He was your favorite college professor who was coming to live with you, but he was your brother disciple and a brother disciple of Swamiji and a true lover of God. And that was what we needed at the time. One thing that Purushottama forgot to mention in the fundraiser was when Honnell would do a concert and Sadhana Devi, his established accompanist, would play the piano and Honnell would come sometimes with a tuxedo. And he would come up, and what would he sing? Would he sing great classics? He would sing the songs of Winnie the Pooh by A.A. Milne. And he just had the most wonderful sense of humor, which I think for all of us gave us an example of what is a lifelong disciple look like? How do they act? What do they behave? What do they do? How do they speak? If you I don't know, I wasn't thinking about someday I'll be a lifelong disciple. I was 22 years old, but it was just really instructive to us, and it was such a help. So Honnell sang the Pooh songs in town at this extravaganza, and he would do concerts, and he would stand up, and he would walk up to the front of the stage as if he was going to sing an aria or something, and he would sing a Pooh song. What shall we do about poor little Tigger? If he never eats nothing, he'll never get bigger. And he would go on. Which was Honnell's way after every song. And then he would walk to the back and then walk out. Sadhana Devi, did you wear a full evening gown for those? She wore something very, very formal from Durga's Free Box. But it was so wonderful because Honnell taught us calligraphy. He taught us speech. Many of us were of the Stephen Gaskin, yeah man, way cool, far out language. And that did not fly because we had a work to do for Swamiji. We couldn't go up on a stage and talk about Kriya Yoga with the hippie slang that we all spoke. I spoke. Cleared of all charges, but he just gave us dignity. And if you wanted to learn calligraphy or voice, I only told Ramesh this a while ago, but Honnell gave voice lessons to us. He taught us how to sing. He taught us how to behave. He would bring us articles from The New Yorker. I didn't know there was a magazine called The New Yorker. I didn't know anything. And read this article. Let's discuss it. Shivani, Devi, Sadhana Devi, Lakshmi, Kirtani, Hridayavasi. They were his granddaughters, and he loved them so much, and there was such respect. And you just look, this is how we're going to grow up. Anandi, Arati, all of the young women, they were eager to work. They had worked in the garden. They had major points, you know, and a lot of them had, but others who hadn't. He showed us respect, and that helped Swamiji, because Swamiji couldn't be with us all day, every day, correcting our English. And when Honnell died, Swamiji did the funeral, and he said, Honnell came to teach us discipline. And in retrospect, the fire brought us to a focus, like, okay, here we go. We're going to have to pick it up a notch. You know, Jyotish had to go get the county to okay those domes, you know, and I don't know if Pura was involved in that, but it was like, okay, we're going to have to build to code. And, you know, I was a contractor at that point, and I knew how to do that, so I was able to help, and I was able to contribute. But Honnell gave us that structure. We were good tree planters. Other skills he showed us, we've got to step up in order to really help Swami, because Master's counting on us. You know, we can't just goof around all the time. We have to be more serious. And it was so interesting. One thing I always remember is January 1st, 1976, we were in the dome at the meditation retreat. Swami, on the 1st of January, would give us a little pep talk, sort of like tone of the year, what we do now. January 1st, 1976, Swami Kriyananda, he sat on the wood box over there by the dome. We were all in the dome. And Swami said, and I quote, I'll never forget this, you know, this may not be a good year for us materially, but we can make it a very good year spiritually. And me being 22 was going to kind of cheer him up and say, come on, Swami, be positive. Say yes to life, you know. By the fire, whoa. It just kind of dawned. Well, it always dawned on us, but Swamiji was on another level of attunement. He knew, and he didn't say it in a heavy way. Just, we can make this good spiritually. Let's work together. Let's pull together. Let's help each other. Let's meditate. Let's keep our sadhana strong. And the greatest, you know, so that year went on, and Honnell helped us, but it was just so amazing for us to think of, this is renunciation. This was a man in, you know, the middle of the New York photography scene. He was an accomplished photographer. His displays of photography were put in museums and shown in museums and stuff. And he was living in a tent at the meditation retreat with no running water, because God's the most important thing. What do you do when you conquer the world? You go off to seek God. You know, he was the original Nayaswami before there was Nayaswamis. That's done it, good, raised his kids, good. Now let's seek God. And that's what he gave us. The greatest honor for the farmers, of course, was to learn farming, but also to meditate with Hanul, because he would say, okay, we're going to build a temple. And each meditation, we're putting another block in this temple of silence and depth. And that was what we were looking for. So we had a model. Where are we going in 10, 20, 30, 40 years? I don't know. I was never thinking about 10, 20, 30 years. I was just thinking about right now. And I would just pester him with questions. Every morning he'd come down to the farm, and I would just start in on, Hanul, what would we do this? How would we do this? I knew I only had a few years with him, and a few years later he left. But he gave us that dignity, and I think from that point, we had another level of maturity. Everything that Master's given us, the fire and the businesses and all that, is always the next step of moving forward in maturing. And that was this process. Right after this, and we'll turn over the stage, but the joy tours, we had to go talk. Well, to talk, you must speak correctly. Hanul had certain little phrases that he would instill upon us for education, which Hiridaya is now the principal of the schools, but he would say, a child that isn't trouble to bring up ain't worth bringing up. And that turned out to be true. And he would give us, he just loved language, and he loved plays on words, and you'd be, you know, just so many comments that he would give us that just gave us a side of discipleship. He wasn't Swami Kriyananda. He was another person, but he had a sense of humor, he had refinement, and he loved to laugh. There was one day on the farm, we were having a bad day. The frost had killed the tomatoes, and a gopher had eaten the clematis, and something else had happened. We all just came to him, Hiridaya, and I think Kirtani, and Maria, and Shivani, and we all just came to Hanul and said, Hanul, a gopher ate the thing. Oh, this happened. And Hanul looked at us, and he goes, let's just quit. We all just broke out into laughter. We'd already been through the fire. There was no quitting. We were not going to quit. And he would just laugh so loud, and all of us would laugh because we saw this is our brother disciple. 50 years later, we want to grow up to be like him. At least I did. And I realized I kind of have. I have a little Japanese pickup truck, and you know, I could get the glasses and get the pelmels, and it could happen. But there was so much respect between Kriyananda and Hanul, too. Just two senior disciples, they would go and have coffee together. Hanul had so much respect for Master, and he had, what was interesting to us was with this accomplished worldview and a scientific understanding of agriculture, he also believed in the power and the magic of the guru. He was never surprised that someone got better, that this happened, that that happened, and he never lost faith in us. He always had faith that these young people, however we were, would become great disciples because God watches the heart. And that's what Hanul did. And that's what Swami did. That's why he would take us. It was kind of crazy, but they really love God. Everything else will work out. And that was, I think, such a great adventure and such a great help. Puru was talking about the finances, but I'll just give you an idea of the scale of the finances. In 1976, if you needed more than $25 for a draw for your department, you had to go to the village council for approval. The gross income of Ananda Farm, 1976, with Kirtani, Shivani, myself, Hiridaya Vasi, Govinda, and James, six people, our gross income was $2,400 for the year. That's barely a dollar a day. And that was the environment that, you know, so the logging and the rebuilding of the community, it was a big scale, but it opened up to us the possibility that God will provide. Do we need $1 million? Great, He'll provide $1 million. Do we need 12 million? 12 million. Whatever we need, God will provide it if we put out that energy. And that's what Hanul would look at, was the dedication. Of course, it was what Swamiji looked at, but Hanul was with us every day at 7:30. Not at 7:30 and 5 seconds. At 7:30, we have a meeting. You were expected to be there. Discipline. discipleship. That's what the message was. And with that, it got easier as we went.
Well, we've been talking about watershed events at Ananda, all the kind of highlights that have been really, really important for us in our life as a community, and so much drama. I mean, when Jyotish was telling about the fire and then the rebuilding and then Honol, it's just so much excitement and energy going on. And this was all the community, and that was all happening. And meanwhile, Swami was the light that was holding it all together, and he had his own sense of what he had to do. He didn't have to worry about the gardens. He didn't have to worry about the rebuilding. He had to express Master, not only through community, but also for the world, to show who Master was and what it meant to be a disciple. And so he lived with Master. Master said to him, "I want you to write down what I say," just implying that he knew that this was his job at some point, to share who he was, who this avatar was. And so he was preparing himself. He began to teach himself how to write by writing many books. And at a certain point, he felt ready to tackle his own autobiography, because his own autobiography was going to share what it was like to be a disciple of Master. And so in 1975, he started in on this project. And why is this project such a watershed for Ananda? What was it about the path? This is the path that came out in 1977. In the path, of course, he tells his own journey as a disciple, and then he talks about being with Master. And just think about what life would be like if there was no Bible, if no one had written what it was like to be with Christ. And he took the path in that way. He was describing life with an avatar. And through that book, it expressed so perfectly what Ananda was, what he was. It's written with the most, well, I was thinking about this. When you read the autobiography of a yogi, you have what Master writes about. But equally important to what he's writing about is the vibration that's coming through the words. This vibration of so much, well, you know what the vibration of the autobiography is. I don't need to say it. But it's the same with the path. As Swami writes this story, there's this vibration of total self-honesty, total self-transparency. He's just there. He's not hiding anything about his mistakes, about his misunderstandings, about, you know, where he missed the boat. So he's just very with you. No games, no hiding. And he's always, always knowing that whatever Master did was going to be right. Even if he didn't understand it, that was always the foundation that he brought through this book. How do I attune to this pole star? This is always going to be in alignment with truth. And so he was bringing that to that. And then he was also just sharing. You know, when people come to Ananda, I've seen this, I'm so grateful to work at a place where I can see what happens day after day when people come here. There's an atmosphere here that they just tune into instantly. Now, this is an atmosphere Swami put out through the way he was, but he also expressed it in the book. There's no need to, it's just total openness, no need to protect yourself. No need to try to put yourself above anybody else. No need to be anything but kind and respectful of everyone who comes. And that vibration, he lived it, and it flows through the path. And I really feel like it's one of the things, the great things that Ananda has to give to the world. Because when people come here, they just get it, because it's the nature of the soul. It resonates. Of course, they wish they could always live like that, but in the world they have to protect themselves, and here they don't. And this is not something you find in every spiritual organization necessarily. So this is coming through the path, and he had to express that. So he started work on this in 1975, and what he did was, as he worked on his little electric typewriter, He would invite the community over. Once a week, we'd go over to his house, and we would sit. The dome was much smaller than it is now, just about two-thirds of the space that's in the main area. And we would sit there, cross-legged on the floor with our eyes closed, while he read us a chapter from the Path. And he was very excited about this and really wanted to know what we thought. And so then he would say, "What do you think?" And we would, for the most part, continue to sit there with our eyes closed. And we were, on the one hand, a little bit afraid. We didn't know what we were supposed to say. We didn't have any great ideas. We were very, very inspired, and we didn't know what to say. So we just sat there with our eyes closed. And then he would kind of go, "Okay, good night." That was it. And finally, after this had gone on for some number of weeks, he just said, "Look, this is not appropriate. You know, I know you're inspired, but I'm here. I'm a person. I want to know what you think. It's not appropriate to just simply take from spiritual teachings and not give back." And so, obviously, after that, we really tried to gear ourselves up and respond. But I felt like that message, which was really important for all of us, the spiritual path, and it comes through the Path, the spiritual path is not a game. It's not trying to look spiritual. This has been called, the Path has been called a textbook in discipleship. And it's actually even more than that, because Swami is saying, here's how you live as a disciple. We're talking about freedom here. We're not talking about who can meditate more, who can serve better, who's cuter and brighter and, you know, has all the right outfits. He really takes you into each lesson and says, what does it look like to respond in the appropriate way? Even if you're so confused, you don't know which way is up. How do you find which way is up? And so in the Path, he leads you through that. If you're going through a tough time, just open the Path. You'll probably open to something that will help you. So this book was very, very important in Swamiji's life. It was very, very important in the life of Ananda, and I feel it's a very important gift to the world. So what happened was he was working on this book, started in 1975. By 1976, in June, he had it to a place where he was doing some final work on it. He was in Hawaii working on the book. The fire happened. He felt it. He was called. He came back immediately. He drew everybody together. He had, a few meetings with people. Felt like, okay, they've got this handled. I'm going back. Finished working on the book. So he just, it was beautiful, really. So you had this whole huge drama of what was going on here. You had Swami holding everyone in this vibration of master and success, and this is going to work. It's in good hands. You can handle this part about those building those domes and figuring out about selling trees. You can do all that stuff. I'm going to do what I can do, which is to finish the book. And so he went back. He was working on the book. Interestingly, as I think Puru said, the monastery didn't burn down. So the nuns were working at publications. Swami would type the book and hand edit on. He was typing it on an electric typewriter. He would hand edit it. Asha would retype it, bring it back. I was working on the index. We were typing, Nalini and another woman were typing the whole manuscript on this one-inch paper with little holes in it that you couldn't see what you were typing. It was like typing Braille. So she would go very, very, very slowly, make these tapes, which we then took to San Francisco. Two nuns would go down on a Friday night. Some man who, he must have been, I don't know, a gift from God or else not all there. But anyway, he led us into his shop on Friday night. He left. He left two women who knew nothing about his equipment. We would run the tape. It would come out with camera-ready copy. We would work through the night to do that, proofreading it as we went. and bring it back, and then Arati and Shankari would type it onto camera-ready pages, and we would continue to proof it and continue to send corrections down and so on. And the book was finished in 1977, and he, as soon as we got it ready to mail off, we were putting Swamiji and Seva and a few other disciples on the plane. They were going to India so that Swamiji could have a period of seclusion after this period of what for him was just enormous, enormous work. You can look at, this is the cover of the path. If you look at Swami's picture on here, you see a lot of fatigue, actually. He was really, really working hard on this book. And he went into seclusion, and when he came out of seclusion and came back, he had a whole new vision of Ananda, and that is what that started the next chapter, which Durga is going to talk about, the Joy Tours.
Hello, everyone. I was going to start and tell a few things about the fire. Since I was here at that time, Vidura was working up in Reading, so he was also not here. But so many of you have spoken so beautifully about it, I won't go into it as much as I was going to, but there were a couple of lessons, and I think all of us are hitting on those as we speak. As I was listening to the singers, I was thinking about the words, the battle we fight, the victories we win are never the victories we know. And I really feel like the fire and the Joy Tours addressed that in some way. We were at what we called Pubble at that time. Most of the, if not all the businesses, were at the Hansa, where Hansa Mandir is right now. And nobody's spoken of the little blue outfits we had then, but we were prepared for fire all the time. And we had little blue outfits, and they were little jackets and pants. And we all had them hanging in our offices. And when we, that day, June 26, 1976, June 28th, okay. We could talk about that later, but anyway. Anyway, it's probably right. We heard the gong going down at the market, and gong, and we knew that that was a sign of fire. We only had two phones in the community at that time. We had the phone at Pubble, the blue phone, and we had the red phone at the market. And if you wanted to use the red phone, you had to come through a little channel that was in the market. You could get it through the market, and you could get at it through inside, and it was set on this little shelf. So that's how we communicated with each other. And so anyway, we, those of us that were there, went up to the ridge, as Jyotish was saying, and watched these flames come. I remember a couple things. One is that I really was praying that God would not take the cedar trees. You know, if you've been up on the ridge, the beautiful cedar trees, and they, even though they got burned, they're still there. And then we went to our homes, and we were trying to get what we could. And it's interesting when some traumatic thing goes on in your life. I don't know if you've experienced this, but it's very surreal. You don't really accept in your mind that this is going to happen. You have no thought in your mind that the community is going to go, that your house is going to go. You just do one thing in front of the other. And so I went home. I didn't know what to take. You know, what should I take? I had the time to take anything I wanted. But sort of like Jyotish, I took Master's picture. Shiva, who was there at that time, yelled, "Take your photographs!" And I thought it was so materialistic. I wish now I had them, but take your photographs. But then I just got Melissa's teddy bear and something for Dwayne, and I was going out the door, and Kalyani came in the door, and she said, "Durga, get your guitar. We're going to need music tonight." And I always appreciated her for that. So we got the guitar, and I got in my car. And then I think Dwayne was with me and our son. He was 13. And we went around and collected as much as we could. But there was some point, and I don't know if it's what when you were talking, but there was some point where he was with a lot of the men in the community, but they were surrounded by fire, and they really weren't sure they were going to get through that. I don't know if Sudarshan or some of the others were there. But what an experience for a 13-year-old. And a lot of what he experienced at Ananda were lessons for life. And that was one of them, just to be, you know, as adult as he could and do. And he loved that. And it was really good for him. So anyway, we went around and we got things. And then we were down at the farm. And as Jyotish said, we just kept hearing, boom, boom. The propane tanks were going. And I think Santosh was going around at that time. We would say, Santosh, you know, is my house still there? No. My house still there? No. One by one, we would realize that they were gone. But again, just like all of you, it wasn't a feeling of sadness. It's just what was happening at the time. And again, I think the shock and all that, but also the spiritual life. Because I was only here 2 years at that point. I didn't know really what was happening. But there are two really important things that I remember most, besides losing the 60 quarts of apricots that I had just put up. And that was the sense of freedom. And I was in our car, and I had a teddy bear, and I had a book, and I had a guitar. And it wasn't like you were consciously, like you were saying, it wasn't like you were consciously thinking of what you were doing, but that sense of freedom. I can't lose anything else, my family maybe, but I can't lose anything material, and I felt so free. And I've always remembered that as a very important lesson, and I know because those clothes and that furniture and those donations came in like this. So many people that didn't even know us. The other thing I wanted to say is that Swami did come back from Hawaii, and I remember, again, I was pretty new at that time, but we all gathered in the dome, and he was sitting there, his Bermuda shorts, his Bermuda shirt, his glasses, his long hair, and his power. I remember just seeing him, you know, and here we were, and it was like, you know, sort of chaos in our minds. What are we going to do next? And he just had this strength about him that I think everybody drew from, and we were able to move on a lot because of that. And I remember someone asking him at that time, but Swamiji, why would all the houses, the nice cabins, the families' homes be taken? And all these little funky trailers over at Ayodhya with the monks and the nuns, and they were saved. Why would that happen? And also, I don't think anyone's mentioned this, there were many, many fires at that time, all up and down the West Coast, in Oregon and Seattle. And so the bombers did come eventually, but they did not come in the beginning. And that's one of the reasons the fire got so large, that we just didn't have the support we needed until later. So Swamiji said, as best as I can remember, he said, if you would read in the paper the next morning, if you were in Nevada City and you got the union and you read that there was a fire and some hippies up in the hills lost their trailers and their teepees, would big deal. It's hard for them, but it wouldn't have an impact on them. But he said, if they read that people with families, children, lost all their toys, lost their homes, that there was still joy, that would make an impact. And that had such an impact on me. First of all, it made me feel way better. And secondly, the teaching that Swami always gave, he always went down to what's happening here. His almost, it wasn't really a joy you felt from him, but a strength in it. This is okay. It was almost like, and I'm putting this in his mind, this is a great lesson. This is something we can really learn from, that Ananda is not the land. Ananda is not our homes. Ananda is an energy. It's a spirit. And just like Puru said, most everyone here said, okay, what can we do next? And also, there was an incident of, I was down at the market, and most of us were down there, and there was a man there named David. I don't remember his last name. Older man. And he had a wealth of books. He was, I don't know what he was, but he had encyclopedias, professor. So he had these books that were very, very dear to him. Of course, he lost everything. And I was down there, and Swamiji came in, and I was thinking, oh, Swamiji's going to come up and say hi. Sort of needed that at that point. He went right past me, right up to David. I said, I'm so, so sorry about that. And afterwards, I thought, yeah, because he knew I was fine. He knew I was fine. This guy really needed it. He really needed it. He didn't stay, but just that support from Swamiji. And he always was there, and he always was an example for us. After the fire, most of us thought about rebuilding. How can we rebuild, and what can we do? And the businesses, new businesses started, and houses went up, and people went out to earn money. Badura went up to Alaska for 4 months so he could earn money to build our house. And Swamiji, after finishing the path and was maybe coming back from Hawaii with this thought, what can we do now? And Swami was always expanding. He was never us four and no more. It's great. People need to be here and build, but we also need to go out, let people know about Paramahansa Yogananda. We had never done it on a large scale before. And so he pulled together what was known, what is still known as the Joy Tours. And this was a time he pulled together 10 or 12 of us. And we had singers. We had six singers. We had Shivani and Kalyani and myself and Maitri and the former Lakshman and Ram, who had only been here a couple months. Swami said, come on, Ram, we're going to go sing. And around we went around the United States for 4 months. Every Friday night, we would land in a new city. We would do, Swami would speak on the practice of joy. Every Friday night for 4 months, he talked about the practice of joy. And you'd think we would get it after that long a time. And then on Saturday, we would do an all-day seminar. Maitri was the head cook. We had to bring all our cooking utensils, everything with us. And then on Sunday, he gave Sunday service, and then we were off to the next city. We also had, so the motorhome that Swamiji bought. So here we are, no money, $25 a month, whatever it was. Swami wanted to buy a big motorhome because we had a lot of people to fit in there. And then we bought a van. So we called the motorhome Sadhu and the van Chela. And Narada, who was with us till a few years ago, wonderful, wonderful soul, he drove the Chela full of books, all the books we would need until more could be sent. And one of us would always go with him during the day. And so that's what we did. And it's interesting how I got involved. I'm not really sure, except there was a little group that had just started called the Gandharvas, the Celestial Singers. And I wasn't part of it, but it had started. And for some reason, all of them couldn't go. I think they had families and things. So he was looking for other people. So we were at a satsang at his dome. He came up to me and said, can you sing? I said, well, I can carry a tune. He said, okay, let's go downstairs and I want to audition you. It was really scary. And so I went downstairs with, I think, Nalini and some other people. And he said, okay, what songs of mine do you know? I didn't know any, none. And you see, at that time, you had the Gandharvas that were just learning the songs. And you had Swamiji that would sing at events. And that's it. It wasn't like all pervasive like it is now. So, I mean, part of it might have been my fault. I'll take it on. But we didn't know the songs that well. So I said, Swami, I don't know any. And he said, well, do you know Silent Night? And I said, yes. And so I sang it. And so he realized I could carry a tune. So, and I think most of it was because Badura wanted him to go to, and he was the recording, did the recording, and was the main driver for the trip. Both trips, there was another joy tour that was in the winter, and the next one was in the fall. And there were a couple interesting things, because Swami always has a teaching. So we got together, and we went the first, we had a little short stint in L.A., and from the time we left the village until we got to L.A. driving, I had to learn all the songs. I had to learn the alto part to all the songs. And we learned them because we never stopped singing for 10 hours. And I had great support from everyone else. And so we got down there and did that. And then one time we were rehearsing, and we did rehearse. The singers rehearsed every day. We stayed in people's homes. And we also tried to rehearse before we were going to go on to sing. And so one time we were practicing. Swami comes in. He says, "What are you doing here?" We said, "Well, we're rehearsing." And he said, "There's guests out there, and they need you to be out there. And they need to learn." He said, "The topic is the practice of joy. You need to show them what that is. And the songs are one thing. They'll get it through vibration, but you need to be out there with them." That was beautiful. Another time, we were at Stephen Gaskin's farm. They had 1,000 members at that point. And he would take, his main thing, I think, besides the teachings, where he would take on any child that someone didn't want. He would also take on any pregnant woman that needed a place to have her baby. So I think they had like 450 children is what sticks in my mind. But they had a lot of children. Everyone had a job. It was beautiful. It was much more, well, actually, probably at the time, it was very much like Ananda. But I was going to say he was more the rock and roll hippie look as opposed to Swami. But Swami had a great affection for him. And I remember him saying, because he comes from his center, he comes from his origin, and he had a great respect. So we were there, and somebody had offered us, this is similar to what you were saying, someone had offered us some oranges, and I said, "Oh no, it's fine, we're just fine, we don't need them." Swami comes up later, says, "Durga, you've got to let people give back to you. You can't just give to them. You've got to let the circle complete." And it was a very, very wonderful lesson for me. There's one more. Oh, I know what it is. So, one more story. We were in Phoenix, and it had been, oh, so I'll tell you how we would set up. So we had this big backdrop. It was bigger than this altar, huge backdrop, very high of the Himalaya Mountains, and we would put it up. It was rolled up. It was canvas, and we would put it up every night, and then we would do the book tables. We would set up where Swami was. He always played the piano, the sonata, if there was a piano there every time. Book tables, recording, everything you do to set up a hall. And so we had done that. We had gone ahead, and we were in Phoenix. It was pouring, pouring rain. And the streets, a lot of water in them, and we were a little bit anxious, but we just did it anyway. And then about 2 hours later, Swamiji arrived. He looks around. "So what's up, gang?" he says. Swamiji, nobody came. Nobody is here. He said, "Okay, put it all together. Let's go out and have dinner." Such a lesson. As like everything that happened to him came from Master. He didn't whine over it. He didn't cry over it. It came from him. And of course, everything that we're watching, we're learning from him. And so the battles we fight, the victories we won, had much deeper meaning. And both those events, the fire and the joy tours, were very, very important to our development as disciples of Master and Swamiji. God bless.
Hey everyone. My name's Latika, and I'm a product of the joy tours. I was living in Washington, D.C. area, which is where I grew up. I had just recently married my husband, Dira, and we had become disciples of Yogananda in 1977. And you might be able to imagine, those of you especially who were born after 1980, no computers, no internet, no way of communicating across a whole nation the way we have now. And so there we were on the East Coast. SRF was in Los Angeles. We were communicating with SRF as best one could by letters, because that was the only way to communicate. But we had no spiritual support. We were just the two of us trying to our best to meditate and to follow the SRF lessons. We were living a typical middle-class life. I was working in a professional job for the U.S. government. My husband was working with a co-op, food co-op. We had our little three-story townhouse. We had our two cars. And we were living a fairly pleasant life. I mean, there was nothing bad about it. But there was something missing in my mind. I felt the need for an opportunity to give. I felt the need for the opportunity to live my spiritual beliefs. I was the only vegetarian I knew where I worked. I was so weird to everybody I worked with. I just wanted satsang. I wanted also to be able to give back what I was feeling from Master's teachings. But there we were, just wandering along, doing our little thing, and life was pretty comfortable. My family lived nearby, and I had lots of friends, and we had enough money to do nice things. We had our own little organic garden in our backyard. So things were pretty good. But my husband, Dira, had never quite accepted Yogananda the way I did. When I first read the AY, I said, this is it. This is my path. This is my guru. I'm in 100%. He was a little bit more skeptical and reserved. He was a Western philosophy major. He was raised as an atheist. So he was a little bit troubled by all these miracles that Master wrote about in that book. And he withheld just a little bit of his energy. So he kept looking around. He kept looking for other things that were appealing to him. And one day he came home from visiting what was the only New Age bookstore that we knew of in our area, which was a bookstore called Yes, which was in Georgetown, Washington, D.C. And he came home and he said, hey, I saw this poster for this guy, Swami Kriyananda. He said, let's go see him. I said, well, why do we need to go see him? And who is he? And he said, I don't know, but he looked interesting. No awareness that he was connected with Yogananda whatsoever. So I said, okay, you know, we'll go see him. So we went to see him. This was in the fall of 1978 as part of the Joy Tours, and it was at this little stone church, very ancient church in Georgetown. And we arrived, and I'm going, okay, well, this will be an interesting evening, but, you know, doesn't really mean anything to me. We walk in, and there is this enormous painting of Master standing with the Himalayas as the background. And I just looked at that, and my eyes got huge. And I turned to look to Dira, and he's looking at me, and I'm going, see? You can't escape. We belong to Master. So it was a wonderful, wonderful evening. I have to confess, I don't remember anything Swami said. I have no idea what he talked about. I remember the music. I remember the energy of the people who were there, the love and the compassion and the respect that they had for each other and for everybody that they interacted with. I remember the book table filled with all these interesting things, including the path. And including, I believe, I'm not positive, but I think the 14 Steps to Perfect Joy, which was the original form of what is now called the Art and Science of Raja Yoga, which is a book. At that time, the 14 Steps to Perfect Joy was a correspondence course that you signed up for, and every 2 weeks you would receive a lesson in the mail, and you study that lesson. So we bought a copy of The Path, and we bought a copy of the tape of the Gandharvas. I don't even remember what the tape was called. And we signed up for the 14 Steps. Well, I commuted to work. I played that tape until it broke. And then I was, of course, bereft because I didn't have it anymore. And Dira read The Path, and he said, okay, I'm on board. And so I look back at that and I think, you know, how interesting that, you know, a little something that at the time seemed like a little glitch in our relationship and a little glitch in our spiritual life brought us to Swami and brought us to Ananda, which has been our life. I was thrilled by the concept of spiritual community. I had grown up in a very close Christian church where my best friends were the people that I went to church with. And we had a very dynamic youth group. And I had at some point during my later high school years and early college years started questioning the dogma of the church. And so I'd walked away from that. And I was very sad, of course, because I didn't have it, but I also couldn't compromise my ideals and just say, well, I'm going to stick with this because I need the community, where I was questioning the dogma of the church. So to me, to find not only a way that I could serve and a way that I could live the teachings every day, but also this concept of spiritual community, of a whole group of people who live their lives every day in service to God and Guru and in joy and in love for each other and for all that they met, was just astounding to me. So we started our little lessons and we started our reading the path and we were listening to the tape until it broke. And then Swami came back around in through Washington, D.C. again. I think it was in January of 1979. And again, we went to see him. Again, I don't remember a word of what he said. But I do remember that it was just more surety about what Ananda had to offer. And remember, they didn't offer us homes that we could come to live in. They didn't offer us jobs when we came. They didn't offer us anything except you can come and you can serve and you can be part of this work. So we started thinking about it more and more. And as the years went by, we kept practicing and studying the lessons, and we started contacting people here at the community. There was a group at that point called the Circle of Joy, which is basically the precursor to Ananda Sangha worldwide. And it consisted of, I don't know, three or four people who put out a little printed newsletter once a month or once a quarter, and who occasionally called you or you could call them. And there we were on the other side of the country, still nothing much happening on the East Coast as far as we knew. And that was our lifeline. And it had all come because Swami had this expansive, amazing concept of when your life is looking difficult, when things are looking like you should pull in and contract, that's when you expand out. I mean, imagine, you know, the community had just gone up in flames. There was nothing here. There was no money. What does Swami do? He buys these big machines to take a whole group of people out on the road for a year, practically. So it was a very exciting time for us to have that opportunity to hook into this community that was so vibrant and so dedicated to God and Guru. And so I'll just tell you the end of the story since I've led you into it a little bit. At some point, Dira's mother moved out to California, and we thought, well, we should go out and visit her in California. And while we're there, maybe we'll go visit Ananda. And then as we got more and more connected with Ananda, we said, well, we'll go visit Ananda, and then we'll spend a couple of days with Dira's mom. So we came out in 1980, and at that time, really all that existed was the meditation retreat. There were things happening at the farm, but for people who were visiting, that was basically what there was. We came, we saw it, we said, wow, this is it. And we said, we'll be back. And we went home, and took us a year. We sold everything, and then we arrived. And as I said, there wasn't much here physically, but there was so much here in terms of spirit and opportunity. And it's been a great ride, a great joy to spend these last 30-something years. And I'm sure that you'll have a chance to talk with other people who came from the Joy Tours. There were a number of others who came as a direct result. I think Krishna Das and Marion Tim Kretzmann, and I'm not sure of others. Who? Oh, Rick Morehouse? Really? I didn't know that. And in future years, you'll get to hear more about those early years of the 1980s. So thank you.
I think what I'll do is kind of give an overview of what happened, of what we've all been saying, and highlight it with areas that I was directly involved with. 1976, you know, the fire. Had to deal with that. But 1977, I'm just reiterating what a lot of people have said, the path gets published. And we also get permission to rebuild what was lost already. 1978, this was a pivotal year now because we've regrouped our energy. 1978, the joy tours go out, and the master plan for rebuilding gets approved. This was a very significant event, and I'll touch on this a little bit because Jyotish and I were directly involved with the last 2 years of this, 76 to 78. We had started this process in 74. Anandi, who had a background, a degree in community planning, even though she denies that she did. And there was another wonderful man named Sam Dardick. Thank you. Sam Dardick, he lived here with his family. He was a wonderful man. He actually was from our hometown. When I say our, Anandi and I were both from St. Louis. He went to the same high school I did. He was part of the afflicted during the great polio epidemic. He was a little bit older than we were, so he was paralyzed from the waist down. But he was married. He had three wonderful children. And Sam had been a very successful city planner in University City, which was actually the community I grew up in. And so Sam started this master plan process, and Anandi helped him, other people. But then by 1976, it wasn't just an interesting experiment to create this master plan. We knew if we didn't get it done, we were shut down. There would be no growth. There would be no permanent houses. So Jyotish and I got involved at that point, and it was a marvelous experience. And I'll go into it a little bit because right now Ananda's in the process of creating a master plan, and it's like night and day. As Sadhana Devi was saying, we were not popular on the ridge. And every step we took, there was opposition. Every public hearing, everyone spoke against us. Every government department we went to, they said, no, you can't do this, you can't do that. And so we had a master plan in works. And again, at the time when there was no money, we had to raise tens of thousands of dollars to get these different water study done. We finish a water study. No, this isn't thorough enough. Okay, we'll do it again. We have to do an archaeological report. I remember this very nice young woman archaeologist came out to see if there were indigenous archaeological sites here that we would destroy by building the community out. She was a graduate student in archaeology. I remember, for those of you who know where the upper garden is near the school, that was the Indians that lived here were Maidu Indians. That was a Maidu Indian burial site. And there were, in the early days of Ananda, many of us would find arrowheads and little carved objects out of bone. And they were on the surface of the ground at that time. And when we were gardening, we would find these things. Anyway, I remember we walked around and she wanted to know where we were developing. And so far, so good. Then we took her over to the Ayodhya area where we had a lot of plans for building. And she said, we don't have to look here for archaeological sites. And we said, well, why not? And she said, oh, no Indian would be dumb enough to build on the North Slope. So, and of course, that's where we had a lot of plans to build. So the woman submitted the archaeological report and said, you know, no disturbance here. We get word back from the county. This woman only had a graduate degree. She didn't have a doctorate degree. So we have to do it again at the cost of many, many thousands. This went on, really the whole process took 4 years, many, many public hearings. I'm actually getting goosebumps when I talk about this. Then I remember the night in 1978 when we made, just as like Judge Tish was talking, having the stand against the fire. This was the big public presentation before the Board of Supervisors, and we came in very ready. We had, and I'll tell you, you know, we had done all the reports. We had done them again. We had done them a third time. And we would go to the, I remember the planning department at that time was a woman named Sharon Bovine, and her assistant was this big guy named Jim Louie. And just to sort of describe, I remember the first time we went into Jim Louie's office, typical of most bureaucrats, he had a little bitty inbox, a huge old box, and a little bitty outbox. And we saw that and we thought, this does not bode well. But they kept blocking us and blocking us. Finally, we're in front of the Board of Supervisors. And, after all the, and every many people on the ridge came, oh, no, you can't let them, these people prove their master plan. It's going to destroy the water usage. It's going to, overpopulation of the area. Many, many people spoke out. And then we began our presentation. We talked, and by this time, literally, it was 12 o'clock at night. We kept going and going. The hearing ended at 2 o'clock in the morning. And we just were there all night. But then we had prepared a task sheet, a chronological, big, big papers of the history of our master plan effort. 1974, request for water report. April, November 1974, water report submitted. 1970, 2 months later, water report rejected. Repeat. And we showed for 4 years how everything we were asked to do, we had done. And everything we had done had not been accepted. And it went on and on. And you could feel the Board of Supervisors, who were good people. They were not the ones that were shutting us down. They were fair-minded people. And one of our great heroes was Eric Rood, who, if you drive the Eric Rood Government Center, he was a great supervisor for Nevada County, and he supported us. But little by little, these people watched what had happened, and you could see them starting to shake their heads. This is 1 o'clock in the morning by now. You could see them starting to, this is not fair how these people have been treated. They have lived with integrity. And finally, 2 o'clock in the morning, they took the vote, and our master plan was approved. And it was just, and we, so that we could build the community. That was 1978. Swami was going out on the joy tour. So there's two different aspects, being able to build what he is out promoting with all, and Durga and all the others out there. And it was a watershed moment. But that wasn't, Swami never was one to stop, rest on his laurels, so to speak. After the approval, I remember once some of our people were in North San Juan. Please don't go there if you've never been there. I think it's where the I'm going to say something very unpopular, but I can only speak the truth as I see it. I think the DNA from Rush Limbaugh was created in North San Juan. So some of our people were there, and this older person was saying, they saw us and they said, is them hippies or is them yogis? And somebody said, them's yogis, and they're okay then. So the tide had turned. And forgive all my friends who like Rush Limbaugh. I'm sorry. This is from my limited perspective. And don't email me about it, please. Okay. So then Swami was looking for the next big step. After the joy tours, this is 1979. Again, this is a pivotal, pivotal year. He sends two of our teachers to Rome because he had been teaching in Italy a lot, just to see, do you think there's fertile soil that we can start a European work? 1979, Swami started what he called the Super Conscious Living Seminars in the Bay Area. First, we did a blitz, and he went all over the Bay Area talking about super conscious living. Then there was culminating in this huge weekend of March 1979. We rented, if those of you who know the building, the Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco, beautiful building. We had people, I don't know if Dr. Peter's here, but Dr. Peter would wear sandwich boards walking up and down Market Street in San Francisco talking about the super conscious living seminars. So no one went home empty-handed, you know. But then it was that event, and we nearly filled the hall. There were a lot of people, over 700, which was a huge number for us at that time. And Swami gave, he wanted to create a system at that people with exercises, the superconscious living exercises, the superconscious living affirmation, and on, a system where our teachings could be applied in a very practical way. And so he gave this wonderful workshop on Saturday, and then he was going to give Sunday service. And I had done a few little classes at the Expanding Light and so forth, but Saturday night, Swami, I don't know if he called us, I think he told us in person, he said, "I want you and Jyotish to help me with Sunday service in the Palace of Fine Arts in front of 700 people." And I just thought, there's no way this is possible. And I remember Swami said, "I'll give the first part of the talk, then I'll invite you both up and you can speak." And I was sitting in the front row, Jyotish, Devi, and Swami was up here, and he was giving his talk, and my mantra, I am sorry to admit, was, "I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't do this." And then I think I was supposed to go before Jyotish, and then I realized he was winding down, Swamiji, and it was time for me, and my mantra was still really strong, "I can't do this." But then I felt psychically this hand, his hand, Swamiji, reach out to my mind and take my mind and bring me up to the stage. And I stood there, and that was my first Sunday service that I ever gave in front of 700 people at the Palace of Fine Arts. And through the grace of God and Swamiji, I was totally... And so he was all those things, the intensity of the fire, the energy that came out of that, and from that super conscious living seminars, he stayed in the Bay Area till August. Then he asked, Jyotish and I had just gone down for that weekend, in the March weekend. And then he said, and we just had little suitcases and a 3-year-old boy. And he said, "Why don't you just stay in San Francisco?" And so we had people bring our clothes in garbage bags. We stayed, and in August of 1979, Ananda House in San Francisco, we founded, which was the first major city ashram. We had a smaller ashram in Sacramento, and we were there for 3 years, and it was a beautiful mansion in the on the corner of Broadway and Fillmore in Pacific Heights. It had been a turn of the century mansion. I think there were 35 rooms or something, and they were all filled. There were about 40 or 50 of us that lived in the house. We'd meditate every morning. Most of the people would go off to work. Then 1980, which comes to the close of our discussion, a woman who owned East West Bookstore, the original in Menlo Park, came to Swamiji. She was an older woman. Virginia Scharfman was her name. And this was the one of the few metaphysical bookstores in the Bay Area. Swami had gone there over the years. And Virginia said to Swami, "I'm getting old. Would you like to buy my bookstore?" And I remember Swami coming back. He was just about to leave and go back to Ananda Village. And he said, without hesitating, he just said yes. And then he came back and he said, "We need to raise, I forget, $50,000 or something like that." And you know, the miracle of loaves and fishes, the money was raised. And so we had San Francisco House in the Bay Area. We had East West Bookstore. And from San Francisco House, the possibility of large city communities was born from East West Bookstore in Menlo Park. The idea of metaphysical bookstores for outreach was born. And now, of course, that migrated to Mountain View. We have them in Seattle. There's one in Portland. And so everything he did was a seed. And nothing, none of those seeds fell on barren soil. They all grew, they took over, they expanded. And 1979, as we mentioned, a team went to Italy. 1979, the team went to San Francisco. 1983, we're getting a little bit ahead, but I'm building a bridge till next year. The Atherton House started, 1983, Centro della Gioia in Assisi started. And so it all moved forward. People from the Joy Tours came, they built this community. And when I sit here and listen to my friends speak, I can't tell you how grateful I am. And I'll paraphrase the words that my brother said a few years ago, when he went to one of Swami's talks. It's an older brother who did not approve of his 22-year-old sister giving up potential life options and coming to live here. But he went up to Swami and he said, "Thank you for the life you've given my sister." And that's all I can say. Everything that we've gone through, it's rich beyond any words can describe. And our singer started off with "Brave Are the People." I'm getting ahead of our story, but that's a song that will always have great significance to me. It's my ringtone on my cell phone. So if you're ever in a store and you hear that going off, it's me. But the reason it is that some years later, we were in Assisi, and once again, we were under attack. We had been reported to the government. They said the Karma Yoga program was slave labor and, you know, all sorts of allegations. And eight of our leaders were arrested and were actually in an Italian medieval prison. And it was the weekend of a big celebration for Masters Mahasamadhi. So Jatish and I were the only teachers left. Everyone else was not only ill or, gee, I can't come today. They were in prison. And so Jatish and I carried, I mean, we were even the singers. Now, and so there we were. So they were taken, they were arrested on, I think it was like a Wednesday. The program was supposed to start Friday night. And everybody's saying, "Oh, let's cancel. And we thought, just as Hanel said, "Should we quit?" We said, "No, we'll do it." And then on Sunday, we were doing Sunday service, and the singers were singing, and someone came running up on the stage, and they said, "They're released." And all the singers spontaneously started singing, "Brave are the people to defend what is holy, to defend what is true. Our Lord on mankind did this duty bestow." So this is a little bit of the story of Ananda. And now it's up to all of you, particularly our next generation, to take it and say, "What can I do?" Don't be afraid of the challenges. They're what build character. I remember when we were rebuilding after the fire, Puru being the most skilled. One day, they had made so many mistakes that they had to tear out what they had done, and we were farther behind at the end of the day than we were at the beginning. And one of the men who did have building school skills said, "Remember, we're not here to build buildings. We're here to build character. And remember, we're not here just to build community. We're here to build character. And what does that character mean? It means the strength to say, under all circumstances, 'I love you, God. Thank you, God.'" And this is the story of Ananda.